Srimad Bhagavatam, continuing in the 12th canto, near the end of the Bhagavatam. I guess this needs to go back to the first canto again. That'll be fun. 12th canto, chapter 8, texts 1 through 5, plus the introduction to the chapter, which I'll read at this point. Srimad Bhagavatam, 12th canto, chapter 8, titled Markandeya's Prayers to Narayana Rishi. This chapter describes how Markandeya Rishi performed austerities, defeated by his potency Cupid and all his associates, and offered prayers to Lord Sri Hari in his forms as Nara and Narayana. Little pet peeve of mine, I take a note from sometimes Nagaraj points out mistakes we make. Of course, I'm not anyone to correct pronunciation of Sanskrit. However, in the pastime of Ajamil, it's very correct. Clearly, Narayana, four syllables, and we commonly just shorten it to three. So, just a point. Sri Shanaka was confused about the extraordinarily long lifespan of Sri Markandeya, who had taken birth in Shanaka's own dynasty, yet who had moved about alone in the ocean of devastation millions of years previously and seen a wonderful child lying on a banyan leaf. It seemed to Shanaka that Markandeya had lived through 2 days of Brahma, and he asked Sri Suta Goswami to explain this. Suta Goswami replied that the sage Markandeya, after receiving the purificatory ritual of Brahminical initiation, Upanaya, from his father, had fixed himself in the vow of lifelong celibacy. He then worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Hari, for six lifetimes of Manu. In the seventh Manvatar, Lord Indra sent Kamadev, Cupid, and his associates to interrupt the sage's austerities. But Markandeya Rishi defeated them by the potency generated from his own penance. Then, to show the mercy to Markandeya, Lord Sri Hari appeared before him in the form of Narayana. Sri Markandeya prostrated himself in obeisances and then worshipped the lords by offering them comfortable seats, water for washing their feet, and other respectful presentations. He then prayed, quote, O Almighty Lord, you bring to life the vital air of all creatures, and you also protect the three worlds, vanquish distress, and award liberation. You never allow those who have taken shelter of you to be defeated by any kind of misery. Attaining your lotus feet is the only auspicious goal for the conditioned souls, and service to you fulfills all their desires. Yet, I can't help but make this connection. This little bird out here is chirping every time I say something. He's translating for all the other birds. I'm used to having somebody translate every sentence, you know. It's really quite pleasing. I'm sorry. Your pastimes, enacted in the mode of pure goodness, can award everyone salvation from material life. Therefore, those who are intelligent worship your personal form of pure goodness named Sri Narayana, along with Nara, who represents your unalloyed devotee. quotation. The living entity bewildered by illusion can directly understand you if he receives the knowledge presented in the Vedas and promulgated by you, the spiritual master of the entire universe. Even great thinkers like Brahma are simply bewildered when they try to understand your identity by struggling on the path of Shankha Yoga. You yourself manifest the proponents of Shankha and other philosophies, and thus your true personal identity remains hidden beneath the designative covering of the Jiva soul. I offer my homage unto you, the Mahapurush. So we'll chant verse 1, and then I'll just, read verse 2 through 5. Sri Shanaka Vacha. Suta jiva charam sadu, vara na vara tam vara, tamasya pari pramatam, ninam tvam paradarshana, suta jiva charam sadu. Varano varatam vara, tamasya pari brahmatam, ninam tvam paradarshana. Krishna Kohuvacha Sutta Jiva Chiram Sado Varano Varatambara Tamasya Pari Brahmatam Ninam Tvam Paradarshana. Please chant. Shri Sanaka Ovacha. Shri Sanaka said, Sutta, O Sutta Goswami, Jiva, may you live, Chiram, for a long time, Sado, O Saint, Vada, please speak, Na, to us, Varatam, of speakers, Vara, O you who are the best, Tasmai, in darkness, Apare, unbounded, Brahmatam, who are wandering, Ninam, from him, Tvam, you, Paradarshana, the seer of the opposite shore. Translation. Shri Shonaka said, O Sutta, may you live a long life. O saintly one, best of speakers, please continue speaking to us. Indeed, only you can show men the path of the ignorance in which they are wandering. Report by disciples of Srila Prabhupada. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the sages saw that Sutta Goswami was about to end his narration of Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus they urged him to first tell the story of Markandeya Rishi. Text 2 through 5. Ayus chirayusham risham mrikandu tanayam jana ka ya kalpante yavarato yavarito yena grishtam hidam jagat sava asmat kulot pana kalpeshmin bhagavarshaba naivad dun napi bhutanam samplava ka pi jayante eka evarnave brahmam dadarsha purusham kila vata patra pute tokam sayam tvekam adbhutanam esham na samshaya bhuyam shuta kotu halamja yata tamnas chindi mahayogin purvashe vapi samata chindi. That's a nice word to remember for later. Translation. Authorities say that Markandeya Rishi, the son of Mrikandu, was an exceptionally long-lived sage who was the only survivor at the end of Brahma's day, when the entire universe was merged in the flood of annihilation. But the same Markandeya Rishi, the foremost descendant of Bhrigu, took birth in my own family during the current day of Brahma. And yet we have not seen an annihilation in this day of Brahma. Also, it is well known that Markandeya was wandering helplessly in the great ocean of annihilation and saw in those fearful waters a wonderful personality, an infant boy, lying alone within the fold of a banyan leaf. O Suta, I am most bewildered and curious about this great sage, Markandeya Rishi. O great yogi, you are universally accepted as the authority on the Puranas. Therefore, kindly dispel my confusion. Lord Brahma's day, consisting of his 12 hours, lasts 4,320,000,000 years, and his night is the same duration. Apparently, Markandeya lived throughout one such day and night, and in the following day of Brahma, continued living as the same Markandeya. It seems that when annihilation occurred during Brahma's night, the sage wandered through the fearful waters of destruction and saw within those waters an extraordinary personality lying on a banyan leaf. All of these mysteries concerning Markandeya will be clarified by Suta Goswami at the request of the great sages. Om Jnana Tamadam Dasya Janam Jana Shalakaya Chaksuhun Manitamina Tasmai Sri Guruvira Maha Mukam Karuti Vachalam Pandim Namja Kirgirim Yakripa Tamahum Bande Sri Guruvim Dimitharina Vancha Kalpa Turuvyas Cha Kripa Sindhu Vaheva Cha Patitanam Pavani Vyo Vaishnavi Vyo Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasti Gaurav Krivinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. One thing I came to realize yesterday as I was preparing for this class is the difference when you're putting together a class for your home temple and when you're putting together a class that's going to be given in a temple in another country. If you're doing it in another country, you have to account for the translation time. Otherwise, this means that your class will be either way too long or way too short accordingly. Just one of those little things that I noticed. I was accused in one of our recent travels of, you know, your class was really, really long. No, it's just a regular class. Yeah, we forgot the translation time. So I won't go over the limits there. So I think a little bit of back history is warranted here, either for the purpose of informing us or for the majority of us, for the purpose of reminding us what's going on. Srimad Bhagavatam, as we know, is originally spoken by Sukadeva Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj. And this took place on the banks of the Ganga at the Sukrata. Now, it really seems to me more devotees should be aware of this place, Sukrata. It's located about halfway, maybe 50 miles outside of Delhi, before you get to Haridwar. It's about a 4 or 5 hour drive or so. It's just about 50 miles before you get to Haridwar. So it's about 4 or 5 miles outside of Delhi either way. And it sits on the banks of the Ganga. And at this point, the Ganga cuts through a very rocky region. And this town is kind of fitted in there at a very peaceful place. And it's a great place of pilgrimage. Many people go there. But it's very rarely recognized for the very significant role that it plays in our Bhagavatam pastime, because this is where they sat and spoke the Bhagavatam. It wasn't, that he just walked down to the river right out of his palace. There was a little distance away. They went to a holy place and this took place. So it's a nice thing to understand where this speaking originally took place. Now, in this assembly, of course, is Suta Goswami, and he's listening very attentively. Then Suta Goswami returns, because he's already been at Namasharanya and left Namasharanya to come here from Sukadeva Goswami. So he returns to Namasharanya, where Shonaka, who's the head of 60,000 rishis and sages, is trying to perform a 1,000-year jugga. They know Kali Yuga's coming, and they want to deter Kali Yuga. So they go to perform this 1,000-year jugga. Of course, we all know the fire doesn't light smoke and all of this and that, and that's a whole other unsuccessful story for another time. Now, Namasharanya itself is also extremely important. It wasn't just randomly chosen, hey, here's a nice forest called Namasharanya, let's just do the jugga here. Two things about Namasharanya. The Vayavya Tantra explains that the place Naimisharanya is actually the hub of the universe. The Lord Brahma designated this to be the hub of the wheel of the universe, this force of Naimisharanya. It's a very powerful place. Secondly, in the Varaha Purana, it notes that any performance of a jugga done in Naimisharanya has the benefit of halting the demoniac nature and demoniac personalities. They'll be curtailed by performance of the jugga here. So this was why these 60,000 sages gathered there particularly to perform this jugga. They're trying to stop the influence of Kali Yuga. Just like, you know, here the Brahmins that do juggas here, we have our particular place. We prefer this site right out here that we've established as opposed to the one that's over by the playground. Obviously, there's a different factor of consciousness and things like that. So the more sanctified and peaceful a place, the better it is for performing jugga. So this is what's going on there. Now, the nature of a devotee is that they prefer to do things for the pleasure of the Lord. And as a result, the devotees of the Lord offer all types of sacrifices for his pleasure. So the devotees, because they're always attached to the service of the Lord, they're contrary to the conditioned souls who are always attached to the pleasures they find in material existence. So Bhagavad Gita, of course, you know, reminds us that the performance of activities in this world that are done for the pleasure of the Lord free us from bondage. So therefore, it's recommended that sacrifices and austerities like that should be performed for the satisfaction of Vishnu. And then, as a result of Vishnu being satisfied, the devotees will be satisfied, and this brings about peace and prosperity for everybody. So the sages knew all of this, and this is why they wanted to perform this jugga, to hopefully halt this influence of Kali Yuga, and again, why they picked Naimisharanya. So another interesting factor here is how we're hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. The conversation between Suta Goswami and Shonaka took place, I'm going to say approximately 65 years after the original speaking between Sukadeva Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj. Prabhupada refers to this as the second speaking of Bhagavatam. So we're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam as Suta Goswami relates the questions that he heard between Parikshit Maharaj and Sukadeva Goswami. And sometimes Suta Goswami is responding directly to the questions Shonaka asked in regards to that original conversation. And so there's simultaneously two dialogues going on, one between Parikshit Maharaj and Sukadeva Goswami, and the other between Suta Goswami and Shonaka and the sages at Naimisharanya. Furthermore, while the king is speaking with Sukadeva Goswami, Sukadeva's relating episodes of history, conversations that took place between Narada and Vyasadeva, conversations between different sages like this. So it's a very layered telling of the history of the Bhagavatam and the stories involved. Fortunately, Prabhupada points out, fortunately for us, we're not held accountable fully for the philosophical wisdom in a chronological order. That philosophical wisdom, as we well know from reading Bhagavatam, is not always in the linear time base that we exist in this world. Most important, Prabhupada says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is we only need to attentively hear the matter of Srimad Bhagavatam to appreciate fully its profound message, even if we're not clear on who is speaking it and when. So that's all kind of the outline of what's brought us up to this point of hearing the end of the Bhagavatam. And that's an interesting thing. Those of us that have been in Alachua for 20 plus years, we are finally nearing the end of Srimad Bhagavatam, 12th canto. And what happens when you finish the Bhagavatam? Well, you go back to the beginning and start all over again. That's the beauty of Srimad Bhagavatam, is that there's never a point at which, oh, okay, I studied that, what's next? Oh, let's do it again. You know? Oh, we finished it again. Okay, let's 40 years from now, another 20 years, okay, let's go back to Srimad Bhagavatam again, you know? So This is the beauty of Srimad Bhagavatam, as we'll discuss later, Nitya Bhagavata Sevaya, eternal service to Bhagavatam. Now, in speaking about this, the sages realize, as this is all going on, the sages realize, wait, Suta Goswami is about to end its class. Well, we don't want him to end his class. They're in a bit of anxiety. Unlike many of us, when we're sitting in a class, sometimes we happen to clandestinely look at our watch, look up at the clock on the wall. If you're sitting in this seat, which all of you take an opportunity to do, you look at the clock back there and go, okay, I better wrap it up. I got 9 minutes left. Or if you're sitting in those seats, you're like, okay, I hope he wraps it up, you know. So unlike us, the sages were in no anxiety due to the time factor being extended. They were thinking, wait, this is about to end. We're having a great time here. Let's don't stop this. Let's continue. So they, you know, think about, well, what is it that we're not clear about? They don't want it to stop, so they present more topics. Now, this reminded me of a verse that Tamahar quoted on Friday that I didn't get the full verse when he quoted it. I wrote him and actually got it. It's an amazing verse in the fourth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 22nd chapter, verse 25. And even though we heard it Friday, I'm going to read it in here. The devotees should gradually increase the culture of devotional service by constant hearing of the transcendental qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These pastimes are like ornamental decorations for the ears of the devotees. Not necessarily big earrings, but ornamental decorations for the ears of devotees, the hearing of the Lord's pastimes. By rendering devotional service and transcending the material qualities, one can easily be fixed in transcendence to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prabhupada's purport. This verse is especially mentioned to substantiate the devotional process of hearing the subject matter. This is wonderful when Prabhupada makes a point like this. You know, this is especially important for such and such. That's when our ears should perk up. So Prabhupada's saying this is a particularly important verse in regards to the process of hearing. We can increase our propensity for devotional service by hearing Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam from realized souls. The more we hear from realized souls, the more we make advancement in our devotional life. The more we advance in devotional life, the more we become detached from the material world. The more we become detached from the material world, as advised by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the more we increase in attachment to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So what is our goal? Our goal as Vaishnavas is to become 100% attached to Krishna. This is what Prabhupada tells us. So Prabhupada lays it out right here. Okay, the more you hear from realized souls, and we might think, okay, well, that guy sitting behind the mic's not so realized, but we're speaking the message of Srila Prabhupada, who is a realized soul. So the more we hear from realized souls, the more we advance. The more we advance, the more detached we become. The more detached we become, the more attached we become spiritually. And the more we become attached spiritually, the more love of Godhead manifests. So it's a very simple process. This one verse right here is the clear pathway to go back to home, back to Godhead. So anyway, I thought it was a very nice verse in regards to how Suta Goswami is being approached by these sages. No, we want to hear more. We want to hear more. Please decorate our ears with more pastimes of the Lord. So this is what the sages are experiencing. They simply don't want the katha, as they say, of Srimad Bhagavatam to finish. And this is actually a very important point on our desires and our preference of what we hear about. It's not just random questions or random unrelated topics. You know, sometimes when I'm traveling with Bhadahari and Indudumna Swami, at the end of a class, there'll be a question. And then later, Bhadahari and I look at each other and go, what was that all about? Where did that come from? Because it's completely unrelated to the subject matter that's just been spoken about, maybe even unrelated to the conversation of devotional service. But the subject matter that the sages presented had to do with what Suta Goswami was talking about, which means they were hearing. They were listening, and therefore they could put a question forward related to the subject here. Now, there's an interesting thing that in this first verse here that Shaunaka does, which is quite significant. He glorifies Suta Goswami and his efforts in speaking the Bhagavatam before he asks the questions. Now, this is a habit that we see prominently throughout our ISKCON society. Before asking a question, the person will give some glorification. This was at the recent Sadhu Santa retreat in North Carolina. This was very prominent. Vaisheshika Prabhu gave a very nice class. Jadwig Maharaj gave a nice class. Who gave the third class there? Yeah. So as the questions were taken, someone would say, oh, thank you so much for that wonderful class, or, you know, blah, blah, whatever, give some glorification, then pose the question. This is actually the proper etiquette. And we see that Shanaka is doing that. Oh, Sutta, may you live a long life. Well, that's a wonderful benediction. The Sanskrit for that, I believe, if I... Chiram Jiva, which reminded me of that wonderful story Prabhupada tells. I've been looking for an excuse to tell that pastime, and I completely forgot to put it in my notes here, but Prabhupada talks about the sage that comes to an assembly, and the king's son is there. And so the king says, please give a benediction to my son. The sage looks at the son, and he says, may you live forever. May you live forever and not die. And then there's another personality, a tapasvi, a brahmacharya. He says, may you die immediately. And then the third personality there is a devotee, a Vaishnava. He says, live or die. And then there's the butcher. He says, don't live, don't die. So the king's a little confused by this, and he asks his minister. And so the minister explains, says, your son, may he live forever, because he's very licentious, Prabhupada uses the word. In other words, he's a total sense enjoyer. He's taking advantage of all the opulence of the kingdom, and he's got so much sinful reaction headed his way when he dies. Don't ever die. Just live forever. And then the tapasvi, Prabhupada explains, he's working so hard, performing so many penances and austerities, such an austere life, die immediately, you'll get your result. And then for the devotee, Prabhupada says, live or die, because the devotee's rendering devotional service in this life, and then in the next life he's going to render devotional service. So live or die as you like. And then for the butcher, says, don't live and don't die, because as a butcher, you're committing so many sinful activities, but if you die, you're going to suffer so badly, but you don't want to commit more sinful activity. So don't live, don't die. So this is the Chiram Jiva that reminded me of that story Prabhupada tells. But this is how Shanaka approaches Sutta Goswami. May you live a long life. Now, this is what you want in a benediction if you're a Vaishnava. May I live a long life of devotional service at the lotus feet of my spiritual master. Who wants a long life, Prabhupada says? Who wants a long life of a tree? There are some trees, he says, that live 5,000 years. But what is the point of that life? So, and then he continues, O saintly one, best of the speakers, please continue speaking to us. Indeed, only you can show men the path out of ignorance for which they're wandering. So, certainly, Shanaka and the 60,000 sages are not these men in ignorance who are wandering in the darkness, but they're presenting themselves in this way. So, the question, or questions that they ask in this chapter, they're very pertinent. And what do the sages do with those questions? They used them to clear up their doubts. Doubts. I mean, the sages have some doubts? I mean, I thought they were sages. But, yes, they do have doubts. Anybody here ever had a doubt about the process of devotional service? Really, only three or four of us? God bless all the rest of you. I take the dust of your feet on my head. So, doubts in Krishna consciousness are a good thing. They allow us to sharpen our understanding and to remove obstacles that are impeding our progress in the topics of understanding Srimad Bhagavatam. And, you know, to be clear, it's not just, you know, us that have doubts or that will have doubts. I mean, even Arjuna had doubts. That's the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, is to remove Arjuna's doubts. You know, Arjuna was doubtful, so Krishna took 18 chapters to give him a reason why he should do what Krishna wants him to do. And after all of that, after all 18 chapters and Krishna explained, what does Krishna say to him? Verses 72 and 73. O son of Pritha, O conqueror of wealth, have you heard this with an attentive mind? There's the caveat. Have you heard it with an attentive mind? And are your ignorance and illusions now dispelled? In other words, are your doubts gone? And Arjuna answers, my dear Krishna, O infallible one, my illusion is now gone. It took 18 chapters, but my illusion is now gone. It's taken us, what, 20, 40, 50 years, and we're still. I've regained my memory by your mercy, And I'm now firm and free from doubt and am prepared to act according to your instructions. Now, in the purport to verse 73, their prophet says something very interesting. He says, actually, anyone who hears spiritual knowledge from a bona fide spiritual master like Krishna or his representative will find that all his doubts are dispelled. It's as simple as that. So any of us that raised our hand, we have doubts, here's the process to get rid of them. Hear from Srila Prabhupada. Boom. Task done. It's that easy. Just hear. My mother used to always tell me, well, if you would have just listened in the first place, you wouldn't be in the mess you're in now. So, now this further purport, I just took a little sentence there, but that purport to verse 73, chapter 18, is really a good one to read and call it your homework assignment if you want to, but go home later today and look through that. It's really quite interesting. So how do doubts arise? Doubts arise when we speculate that we know better. And that's what was happening with Arjuna. Arjuna was thinking, I know better than Krishna. I don't want to kill these people. They're my guru, my family members, my seniors, my elders, you know. So usually our own speculation doesn't have to do with life and death matters. I mean, ultimately it does, but in the immediate sense, our speculation doesn't. It's usually got to do with something much more basic. But what will bring us sense gratification? That's generally what we're doubting. If I give this up, my sense gratification is going to diminish. And if I do this, my sense gratification will increase. So, you know, we're doubtful in that sense that we want to decrease our sense gratification. But the point is that speculation about our duty is what causes our doubts. Our duty is very clearly laid out, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, the instructions from the spiritual master. All we have to do is follow the acharyas. We follow the teachings of Srila Prabhupada. We follow the teachings of our previous acharyas. And everything will be cleared up. One of my favorite letters from Prabhupada, a devotee had written, there was like 20 questions. What about this? 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 And Prabhupada answers, you know, very briefly but distinctly each of these different questions. And at the end, Prabhupada says, so at any rate, if you do not know the answer to these questions, then use your common sense, comma. And if you have no common sense, find someone that does. So Prabhupada was in no illusion about who he was dealing with. So, but even our acharyas have doubts. This is the importance of studying the lives of our Vaishnava acharyas, to see what their life can teach us about our own path in devotional service. And one of the most telling scenarios of this is the story of Mukunda Gadadhar and Pundarik Vidhiniti. We have Pundarik Vidhiniti sitting right in front of us, so he knows this story better than me, I'm sure. But Mukunda and Gadadhar were very good friends. And Mukunda said one day to Gadadhar, there's this great saintly personality who speaks glorious subject matters of the Srimad Bhagavatam. I'd like you to come and meet him. So wonderful. And Gadadhar is a lifelong brahmacharya, very strict, nice deep, very, very serious, and performed different types of austerities. And so he was, you know, thinking in that like mind, well, if there's a great advanced devotee speaking of the Bhagavatam, he must be a very renounced personality, very, you know, serious, and, you know, wow, this would be great. So he went with Mukunda. And Mukunda was already a disciple of Pundarik Vidhiniti, so he wanted to share his experience. So when they arrived there, of course, the story is quite lengthy, but when they arrived there, Pundarik Vidhiniti, as we know, was seated on this just absolutely incredibly opulent arrangement, this fabulous silk-covered throne with bolsters as white as the waves of the ocean, as they say, and a beautiful canopy with three rows of pearls hanging off of it, and you know, there was a golden spittoon here and a golden bowl with a pawn over here and one servant here fanning him and another servant here holding a mirror so he could look. And he had on this incredible turban and just, I mean, dressed to the nines, as we would say, actually dressed to the 18s. He was really decked out. And, you know, Gadadhar walked into this and he looked at this and immediately his mind was filled with doubts. This is an advanced devotee? This is who I'm going to hear the Bhagavatam from? Mukunda was a very advanced devotee himself and could perceive just by the expression and the bodily movements of Gadadhar that there was some doubt arising in Gadadhar's mind about the spiritual nature of Kundalini. So Mukunda recited a particular verse which drove Pundarik Vidyanidhi into the greatest heights of ecstasy. So much so that he fainted and fell off of his royal throne. At that point, Gadadhar Pandit could understand, oh, this is a very advanced devotee. I've made a great offense. Now, this is an interesting point in this story. Gadadhar hasn't said a word to anybody. It's not like he took Mukunda and said, hey, Mukunda, come here. This guy? Really? Are you serious? He didn't say anything like that. That's what we would do. Or we'd hop on the internet, dear Prabhu, I just go on for 3 or 4 pages. Yeah. So, but he simply thought in his mind, when he was proven to be incorrect in his assumption, and we all know what they say about assumptions, when he was proven to be incorrect in that regards, he immediately thought, I've made an offense. This is the level of an advanced devotee. They think that if they've done something wrong, this is an offense. Even though they may not have said anything or approached anyone or, you know, he feels like that. So he decided the only proper rectification for this offense is I should take initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi. And with full purity of intent and mind, he surrendered himself to Pundarik Vidyanidhi. All of his doubts were removed. So this is what's going on here. Is that we're seeing that this pastime is involving the fact that there is some doubt there. Shonaka is realizing, well, wait a minute, this sage Markandeya, he's in my own family line. You're telling me he lived, for and I originally had this figured out here, 8,640,000,000 earth years. But I forgot that he lived into a second age, so we have to add another, so that's 12,960,000,000 earth years Markandeya Rishi lived. Now, that's a long time, even by demigod standards. And Shonaka realizes, well, he's in my dynasty, and this is an indication of how advanced Shonaka is. He knows, well, wait a minute, there hasn't been a day of Brahma finished yet because we haven't had an annihilation. How many of us can think in those terms? Wait a minute, this must be that day of Brahma because we passed this many avatars and there's been no annihilation. We don't think like that. So Shonaka is realizing, okay, we're looking here at 12,960,000,000 years Markandeya lived. I've been around part of that and there's been no, so I don't get this. Can you explain this to me? And so Sutta Goswami begins to explain this story. Now, the interesting thing about the story of Markandeya Rishi, it just was mentioned in this introduction to the chapter, which once I say this, you'll all understand clearly where I'm coming from. There's something amazingly attractive about a little kid laying on a leaf chewing on their toes. You know, if you've recently had the opportunity of going through being a grandparent and seeing that little kid for the first time, they get to that point where they become more active. They're laying on their back and they pull their toes up and start chewing on them. Now, they may not be laying on a banyan leaf like Lord Krishna was in this pastime with Markandeya, but it just so attracts the mind. Imagine how much more it attracts the mind if this is actually Krishna and you're actually an advanced sage, not just some attached grandfather. So, you know, this is what Markandeya is seeing. And the other thing is, devastation took place. We know that Soshin, I was speaking on the third canto, and the third canto was discussing the 4 different types of annihilation. These 4 different types of annihilations all involve, to some degree or another, everything being destroyed. Now, at the end of the day of Brahma, everything gets destroyed, except Markandeya Rishi. How powerful is he that everything around him is destroyed, and he's walking through the waters of devastation, just, you know, okay, what's next? This reminded me of back in, this would have been like 85 or something, when I was living in New York City, there was this massive hurricane that hit Long Island. And we were living in the Brooklyn Temple. And for some crazy reason, due to insanity, myself, Achyuta, and a devotee named Gauranga decided we wanted to go out and meet this hurricane head on. So we drove out to Long Island, where the hurricane was landing. And you know those rock jetties that go out into the... So we climbed out on the end of one of those as it was coming. And I remember very clearly, we were literally laying horizontal, grasping these boulders as this thing went over the top. So, you know, a little insane, but this isn't what the experience was like that Markandeya Rishi had. He was rather unaffectedly walking through the, what was the word used? Fearlessly, I believe it says. Fearlessly walking through the waters of devastation. Who else at the end of creation is still around and able to do that? So, you know, this all caused Shanika to have some doubts, some questions. What's really going on here? How is it possible that, you know, aside from the fact that he's living an incredibly long life, how is it possible that he's able to do all this? So he puts these questions forward. Now, here's a really important point. He puts the questions forward in a submissive, inquiring mood. Sometimes questions come and they're in a very challenging mood. Mostly when we're out in the field preaching, that this happens a lot of times when I'm at Woodstock and doing the question and answer booth, sometimes somebody gets a little testy, you could say. Matter of fact, we have security guards in the question and answer booth just for these purposes, and sometimes they are needed. Prabhu, that one goes out. So they're politely removed. But this isn't the type of questioning that's going on here. Shanika's questioning in a very respectful mood. And what does he say? And this is where this word comes in I mentioned earlier. Chindi samsaya. Please cut my doubts. This is how we approach a spiritual master. This is how we approach a spiritual authority. I have some doubt. You please put it to rest. And, of course, we know this word sadhu to some degree in its translations means to cut. To cut the doubts, to cut the attachments, to cut the familial comforts. It's explained how sadhus would go traveling from place to place, home to home, and speak to the householder about becoming a bit more renounced and giving up their attachments and all like that. So this is where the meaning, one of the meanings of sadhu, one who cuts off one's doubts, as Shanika is asking, or cuts off one's attachments, or one's familial comforts like this. This is the purpose of a sadhu. So Shanika asked for these doubts that I've got here to be removed. And this is the real reason and result of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. We listen to the Bhagavatam so that our doubts will be removed. We're conditioned living beings. We have so much entanglement with the material energy, and the result of that entanglement will present doubts. Now, to how basic or how complicated those doubts are, someone like myself, the doubts are, will I really be happy if I give up sense gratification? And someone like Shanika is, could you just explain to me how Markandeya lived for 9 billion years? So, you know, there's a different degree of doubt according to one's level of realization. But this is why Srila Prabhupada has explained in the very beginning, Nitya Bhagavata Sevaya, that we have regular, this word Nitya means regulated or steady, eternal hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And what is that service to the Bhagavatam? Just that hearing, as I read from Prabhupada earlier, simply by hearing Bhagavatam, we become purified. So by regularly hearing from the Bhagavatam, by becoming purified, by discussing it amongst ourselves and understanding it, that allows us to become purified. And hearing is the service to Bhagavatam. It's that easy, you know. This is the example that we find. You hear even from ancient times. These sages are very happy to submissively sit and hear about Srimad Bhagavatam to the point that they're not worried about, oh, I have to be at work in 50 minutes, or, oh, I got to get the kids to school, or whatever. They're just happy to sit there and listen. And when they fear that the discussion is going to be over, oh, but wait a minute, what about this question? So they put more subject matters out so they can extend the process of hearing. So this is the process of submissive hearing that is important to us. And way back in the beginning of our study of Krishna consciousness, Bhagavad Gita, third chapter, Tad Vidhi Pratipratena, this whole idea of learning the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquiring submissively, and rendering service. So rendering physical service, but also one of those services is to hear what the spiritual pastor is telling us. So this is our mood. This is our example of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. And as we progress further and further through this chapter, we will see that the sages are exploring how their doubts can be removed by Sutta Goswami. Now, there was one thing when I was reading an introduction here that came across my mind. Let me just refresh this real quick. Yes. It mentions that when Markandeya approached Narayana, he worshipped them, and it begins to give the breakdown here. In the verse, it goes more into detail. First, he offered them seats, idamasanam. Then he washed their feet, idam padyam. Then argyam, achmaniyam, maruparkam. Like this. This is how you respectfully honor or receive a high personality or spiritual personality. So this process here we see is very similar to the method in which we're trained to worship the Lord. In our deity worship, this is the first thing: invite the Lord to come and have their seat, wash the feet. After washing the feet, sprinkle argyam on the head. Then from there, give achman to rinse the mouth. Then madhu parkam, some nice sweet drink. Then rinsing the mouth again, and so on like that. So this process of deity worship, sometimes, you know, there's a question about it, but here we see that even in ancient times, this was the recommended process for how to receive a great personality. So we'll finish there. Just a few comments and things to say on this chapter of 8 as we begin to see Markandeya's amazing potency at conquering. Oh, that was the other thing, too, is that as soon as it mentions here that Markandeya worshiped the Lord for 6 lifetimes of Manu, and then on the 7th, Indra begins to get a little concerned. Indra begins to think, oh, here's another sage going to take my position. Now, this is the interesting thing I never could figure out. Why does Indra think these sages who are renunciates want anything to do with his position? Does he really think all these great sages are doing renunciation and, you know, performing austerities for the purpose of getting his spot? For all the sense gratification in the world, that they're focused in devotional service. But he's constantly worried, and that worry comes from thinking he's the owner and controller. I'm in charge here. This is all mine. I don't want to lose it. I'm very attached to all this. So, I mean, we offer all respects to Indra. He's a great devotee, and he's a high personality in managerial affairs. We don't mean to disrespect him. However, his example is very telling to us as we follow the Vaishnava path of renunciation, because he's always worried somebody's going to take what I have. Prahlad Maharaj explains in the 7th canto, this seeing my enemies and friends, this is the mentality of a materialist. So here he sees Markandeya, he lasts long enough to, you know, outlive the annihilation of the universe, and Indra thinks he's good. Set the bell, I gotta finish. Indra thinks that it's, that he's going to come and take his kingdom. So then he sends all the Cupids, and of course, Markandeya's like, really? This? I gave that up 6 manvantars ago. I'm not interested in this. So anyway, I always find it interesting when Indra kind of puts his thumb in the works, and it always backfires on him. Indra, you know, all glories to him. Indra never comes out of these arrangements looking good, you know. Either he's covered with all kinds of things we won't even discuss, or he ends up having to go to Krishna and ask for forgiveness. And what does Krishna do? Krishna just literally does that, turns his back. Indra comes to Krishna at the end of the Govardhan fiasco, and he tries to offer prayers, and Krishna just turns his back. I'm having nothing to do with you. Nothing. So then Indra, of course, has to go and get Sarabi and Aravata and all of this, and, you know, thus we have Govindakund, which is a wonderful place for forgiveness. But at any rate, so, yeah, we see these activities sometimes. Even the high advanced personalities in the heavenly planets are beset with the same obstacles of advancement that we are. So it's no big deal in getting up there. We want to instead go back to home, back to Godhead. And thus we hear Srimad Bhagavatam radio. All right, thank you very much. Oh, my goodness, so many questions. All right. Yes, Mother Ragatmaka?
Thank you, Prabhu, for your very informative class, wherein you inspired us about the importance of hearing transcendental sound. I just realized I don't know where Namishiranya is geographically situated.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question I have is, what was the homework assignment you gave us?
Verse 73, chapter 18, Bhagavad Gita purport. I won't be here next week to test you on it, so you can get by with that. I'll turn to our scholar and esteemed knower of all things Vedic. Where is Namishiranya exactly geographically located, Prangovinda Prabhu? What's that, Pundarik?
Northwest of
Lucknow, about an hour or two. Say that again?
It's kind of on the way to Hardwar from Lucknow.
Okay, there we go.
It's close to
Lucknow. So it's in that same area of spirituality, that
or
circle, so to speak, of... Right, there we go. Yeah. I usually kind of get those things in there. I missed that. Thank you. Yes. Either way, either one of you take it. She's just scratching her head. No? Yes? No, you actually have a... Okay. Yes, Mother Monica.
Thank you for your nice class, inspiring class. All best of the speakers.
I knew somebody was going to take that wrong. I'm none of the above.
Oh, one who speaks about Vaishnava Acharya so eloquently.
Okay, well, half of that's true.
Oh, one who dresses so...
All right. Yes, you have a question in there somewhere?
Please clarify my doubt.
Oh, boy.
Srila Prabhupada mentions in Nectar Devotion that, you know, four people approach... Krishna, and one of them is inquisitive.
Mm.
And he mentions that, for that he mentions the sages of Namishiranya as being the people who approach Krishna because they were inquisitive.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, is there a difference, and if there is a difference between being inquisitive and being doubtful?
Well, that answer seems to be, to me, one of personal understanding. I don't know of a Shastra verse that would answer that, but I think they're the same, because if you have doubts and you submissively inquire, the purpose for that inquiry is to remove those doubts, as exemplified by the sages here. There, you know, Shonaka is asking because he has this doubt, and so his inquiry is a submissive inquiry to the right personality to clear up that doubt. So the inquisitive nature is, by its own action, removing the doubt. Uh-huh. In reference to that, or a second one? Yeah, go ahead. We'll go to her question as soon as he helps answer this question. Say again, Prabhu.
You've
both got...
The doubt is like demon, Prabhupada speaks. I was just remembering how devotees, a lot of times, they ask questions not for themselves, but for others. Mm. So like Arjun, he wasn't asking those questions specifically for himself. And a lot of the questions that were asked by Maharaj Cricket to Sukadeva Goswami was because of the people that were sitting there listening. Some of them were on different levels, so he asked a question for their benefit.
Well, was Arjuna asking a question for others, or really asking for himself, because he was under the influence of Yogamaya, Mahamaya?
Well,
he was influenced like that so that the pastime could take place. So he was genuinely asking because he genuinely felt like that. although we know that it was the Lord's Leela.
Okay, how about with the Sukadeva Goswami, the Maharaj Brigid? He said a lot of times he asked questions because there were impersonalists in the audience and there was different things that he wanted to have them hear also. So sometimes they do it for the benefit of others.
Yeah. Let's take our mic back over here.
Great to have you here. Love your classes. Thank you. Number one, from my personal experience, I have a doubt. My mind is being a little cynical. You know, I doubt that this is true. I doubt this is real. But inquisitive is like, for me, it's like more objective, more innocent. You know, you're inquisitive. Like, why is that happening? When you doubt sometimes, you say, that's just my perspective.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about this place you're talking about. You see it, I think I saw it when I was traveling on the train from India to Rishikesh, you know, I live
Which in... Which place?
The sacred place you're talking about. Could you spell it for me?
Naimisharanya?
Yeah. Could you spell it for me?
N-A-I-M-I-S-A-R-A...
Slow down a little. Oh. N-A-I...
N-A-I... M... I-S A-R-Y-N-A.
Thank you. I just wonder if it was this beautiful place I saw.
I've never been
there.
I take that back. Actually,
I didn't know
I did
every spot. You know, I saw these magnificent places and I didn't have a book. I didn't know exactly what they might be, what happened. They may have happened there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, we'll finish for today. Thank you very much for your patience. All glories to Srimad Bhagavatam.